The story of the two sisters, Martha and Mary, is really quite straightforward. I don't think it's too mysterious. It's, as far as Bible goes, it's an easy one. And Jesus shows up at the sister's house, and Martha's doing all the work. Yeah? Mary sits and listens to Jesus, and Martha complains to Jesus. Jesus tells Mary that she's distracted, and Mary has chosen the one necessary thing, the one needful thing, the one thing needful, that one part, that one activity, that one thing that is absolutely necessary. Unum est necessarium. Yeah, that's the way this morning is going to go. Latin. Unum est necessarium. I think a few years ago, I ran into one of my favorite guys is a guy named Thomas Merton. He gave me this word. Unum est, I like the drips, necessarium. Unum est necessarium. One thing, the one necessary. Unum est necessarium. I don't know why I like the words unum est necessarium as opposed to one thing. I think it's because it sticks in my brain better. Because I don't know Latin. I know some Hebrew and Greek, but I don't know Latin. Unum est necessarium. It was more readable without the drips. But unum est necessarium. I think the fact that it kind of goes, you know, all Latin helps it stick in my brain. Maybe it'll help stick in your brain. Yeah? Here, try it on, okay? You can walk out of church today saying, like, I know Latin. I can put it right in there with E pluribus unum. And unum, here, you guys over here, can you see that? Unum est necessarium. Try it here. Here we go. Everyone all together. You can all be fools together. Ready? Here we go. One, two, three. Unum est necessarium. But say it with a British accent because it makes you sound so much more intelligent. Unum est necessarium. There you go. Now you're from Oxford. If you don't understand what this means right now, you're really going to be lost in the next 20 minutes. Unum est necessarium. One thing necessary. So just what is the one thing necessary? Unum est necessarium. For that moment in history, 28 AD, or thereabouts, the gospel writer Luke is telling his readers that at that time, he's saying, listen, Martha, the presence of God is sitting in your living room, in your house. The king has come, the one that's been expected now for about 800 years, if not more. And he's right here in person. The Spirit of God, the voice of God, the Logos, the thought, the mind of God in flesh, right in your presence. You know that one burning question you've always had? Well, here he is. You know, ask away. Better yet, why don't you just be quiet and listen? Just listen. Sit at his feet, immerse yourself in his way, attune yourself to the Spirit's voice of God, and understand what it's like to sit in God's presence. Tune in, or you're going to be left running around like a chicken with your head cut off, is what Luke's trying to tell us. You're distracted, Martha. Yeah. You're distracted. See, folks, here's the thing. And I'm really talking about people who are committed Christians. We all know Christians that are Christians in name only. Yeah? I mean, it's not us, of course, but we know some like them that are Christians in name only. They don't pray more than a few seconds a day. They live their lives in Jesus' name only, like it's some sort of political party. And they just believe the right confessional dogma and creeds. But if you looked at their life, there's really very little difference between them and the surrounding culture. They spend their money the same. They use basically the same language. They watch the same shows. They go to all the same places. They deal in the same currency. What are they? They're just Christians in name only. I mean, you know, it's kind of like this. I mean, I got golf clubs, but that sure doesn't make me a golfer. You know? Some people go to church, and that doesn't necessarily make them a Christian. Or don't go to church and just call themselves a Christian, and that doesn't make them a Christian either. Now, we don't have Jesus sitting in our living room. Yeah? That's the scandal of time right there. But we do have the Spirit. And we have to settle these days for sitting at Jesus' feet in prayer. What's the one necessary thing? Unum est necessarium? Prayer. Prayer is the unum est necessarium. 25 years ago, when I heard the one necessary thing is prayer, I thought it was going to be like prayer. I don't like prayer. I'm not good at prayer. Prayer and me are oil and water. I don't do prayer very well. It sounds like getting your teeth cleaned or going to the annual physical or something like that. Prayer's painful. It takes a lot of imagination and a lot of work, and I can't dream up that much stuff. And so, you know, I end up saying just and really a lot when I pray. Lord, just really help me just really come up with a lot of words of just and really. And that's what we do during prayer. Or I do anyway. See, I took the test, right? Prayer didn't come up on the list of what I am. It came up administrator, leader, strategist, activist, entrepreneur, church planner, all that sort of stuff. Prayer type person, not on the list. Not for me. But in the middle of all this doernicity, I'd steal away and go fly fishing by myself. I loved getting up at 4:30 in the morning and driving to the Ozarks and fishing. Just me. Fly fishing seemed to kind of purge my soul. I could stand in the water much longer than probably anybody else around me. I didn't even realize it. I could stand there and slap the water with a hook, pick it up again and do it again and again and again. And by lunchtime, I would realize after a few years that I had been praying the whole time. Me and God wrestling through all my little conversations in the background of my mind. A purging time. Years ago, I bought a new car. Only new car I ever bought in my whole life. I thought, I want a new car. I was in my 20s. I bought a new car, but I decided not to put a tape player in it, so it kind of dates me. I stopped, and I like music. I play guitar. I stopped the deluge of music in my life. And I don't like the radio, too many commercials, so I just drive in silence. And soon I got to where I love driving in silence. I didn't like what was going on inside my head while I drove in silence, because I'm sitting around, you know, running commentary on all the drivers around me, you know, kind of the John Madden of driver going on there, you know. I could take off walking in the woods, still do it today. I can start off walking fast, and after a while, I'll wear myself out, and I'll begin to slow down, and God will begin to say to me, so, walking fast, are you? Got some place to go, do you? Got a lot going on in your brain, do you? Busy, huh? Yeah, God, that's me. That's me. You know, but if you ask me to pray, like, at, you know, you have this thing when you're a pastor, and it's probably some of you guys too, you know, the MRP, most religious person. So, like, if you're a family Thanksgiving gathering, you're the MRP. So, you know, that means you kind of, like, top everybody else. So when they're going to say, Dan, would you do I don't know if it's like a cuss word to say pray or something, you know, or whatever it is, but would you do prayer? Yeah, that thing. All right. Well, it's like drinking cod liver oil, you know, like, okay, I guess it's got to be nice. Can't really say what I want to say about the in-laws, but thanks, God, for the food. Just really. Mm-hmm. Amen. I got to dream up stuff to say. It wasn't unum est necessarium. It was unum est boredom, you know. Now, I'm pretty good with communal prayer now, with praying with other people, but it's been a long journey to get there. Years ago, I started to go to the top of Nolan Road to the Franciscan Prayer Center. There's some sisters up there. It's a Catholic nunnery. And I found that I began to, I'd go up there to work, but I began to crave the quiet that I found up there. I fell asleep, usually around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd more or less pass out, you know, books open, pencil in hand, you know. Then I began to walk the grounds on their trails. Then I'd come back and I'd begin to write out my thoughts in a journal. I wasn't too big on journaling either. I'd read the Bible, I'd read spiritual books, but mostly I just stopped life as I knew it, of busyness and unum est necessarium. Unum est necessarium, yeah. I'd do it because solitude began to breathe life back into me. Now, I didn't call it solitude. I didn't call it unum est necessarium. I didn't call it anything. I was just getting away so I could try and get some work done. But something else was going on. Mostly, I began to wrestle with God. No, I wasn't wrestling. I was wrestling. Wrestle. We'd duke it out. I'd accuse God of stuff, and he'd point out all my compulsions and those things about I walk around and grumble about. We'd go back and forth. He always wins. And after the fighting slows down, I begin to listen, and I begin to sit at Jesus' feet, and I just begin to wait. But don't tell me that I'm praying, because I don't do prayer well. Instead, I've just learned to converse with Jesus when I shut up and get quiet and get away to the right place and the right time. See, since then, I've been doing this for so however many years, I've really begun to identify with the Psalms. I now understand what the Psalms are all about. They're prayers. They're people, you know, that are pouring out their heart, David mostly, pouring out his heart to God, saying the worst things possible. Kill my enemies, smash their babies. That's the way I really feel. And you're like, you know how many people want to throw that out of the Bible? I'm like, well, you're missing the point. It's not prescriptive, it's descriptive. David's describing what's going on inside of him. And it's us who are living in the false world who actually can't pray our real emotions out to God. Oh, God, you're so big. You know, like, well, what kind of prayer is that? I like all the trashy characters of the Old Testament. I mean, they're all squirrely, you know. We've been reading the Bible to the kids at night, you know, this child story Bible. And sure enough, you know, we just got through doing the kings and all the various kings of Israel and Judah. And every night I was like, okay, Mom, okay, Dad, what's this, going to be another loser kind of bad king? Sure enough, it's another bad loser king who did a lot of bad loser stuff. I like these guys like Abraham and Moses and Isaac and David and Jeremiah. Jonah, there's a favorite. I like Jonah. He's a mess. Hosea, he's the one who marries the prostitute. Oh, yeah, and she keeps being a prostitute. They're all sinners who connect with God. Oh, moreover, they're prophets. They're patriarchs. They're the heroes. They're the ones we hear the stories about. This is the Hebrew God. This is the God of the Bible. These are the people of the Bible. These are the ones who are teaching us how to pray. But don't tell me that I'm praying like those guys necessarily, unless it's all the trashy stuff, because I'm not a pray person. I just talk with Jesus. So I got to ask you right now, think about your own prayer life. What are your prayers like? Are they kind of formal and stodgy and dry, and how long are they? I mean, is it cod liver oil? Or are you like me? You don't pray. You just talk with Jesus. Unum est necessarium. Now, my point of telling you all this about myself and asking these questions and so forth isn't, you know, to tell you this because I have all my stuff together. I'm telling you it because I'm saying there's another way of being spiritual. there's a unique way of being spiritual that most of us don't think about who are involved with religion. Because being religious and being spiritual are two different things. The funny thing about our take on Martha and Mary is that we all understand we're supposed to do the unum est necessarium. We all understand that. We know we're supposed to be like Mary. We know that we're supposed to tackle our soul, you know, with all the Martha we can muster and do our religion and our Christianity with all the Martha we can dredge up. Be Martha, Martha, Martha about our churchiness. And we think we have to become super organized and super productive, super doerness, and control our wandering minds and enslave our soul to do our bidding so that we can be very religious and eliminate all the sin in our life and get all Stephen Covey and Seven Habits of Really Uptight People and all that sort of thing. Subdue and conquer our flesh. I mean, isn't that what Lent's all about? Subduing and conquering yourself. Unum est necessarium. Unum est necessarium walks in and says, why don't you just sit down at Jesus' feet, take a load off, and shut up. Despite spiritual roots, deep spiritual roots are not grown through productivity and perfection. I'll just repeat it. Deep spiritual roots are not grown through productivity and perfection. That's religion. That's not unum est necessarium. Rather, deep spiritual roots come from sitting and listening, quiet and listening. Better than lots of Bible information and hearing lots of speeches and sermons and starting programs to serve the poor and raise up thriving kids, etc., 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 is time and space, time and place carved out. You ought to write those two words down, time and place. Carve out time, find yourself a place. It's not about what, it's about when and where. That's what we have a problem with in America, is when and where, not what. We have a lot of what. We got information coming at us all day long. It'll tell you what to do, how to behave. I'm doing it to you right now. It's not about what. It's about when and where. Time and place is what makes spirituality happen in our souls. So one thing we don't want to do. My wife takes a few hours of solitude nearly every week. It is possible. It's possible to have a job, be a stay-at-home mom, be a dad, work all week, and carve out solitude, time and place, a few hours where you can wrestle with God. But you won't be able to do it at home. I bet you won't be able to do it at home. Unless you have like some little sanctuary set off somewhere, some closet you can go crawl into. I think you probably have to leave. I bet you got to get out of there. You'll have to go someplace. Go to the library. I have a favorite place I go now. I kind of hesitate to tell you because I'm can I use coded language? It's down near the Nelson, and it's a library, and hardly anyone's in there. Lots of sunshine coming through the windows. You know, kind of one of those places where a dog would curl up and just fall asleep. Really cool club chairs. I can go in there, spend hours. I got a real nice office at home. I got a nice office here. Can't do either one of them for spending time with God. I got to get rid of distractions because if I'm in my office, I'm going to start doing other stuff. Email. It's always about checking email. It'll get you every time. Time and space. That's what it takes. You get away to the park or some quiet place during lunch and avoid the whole thing of like trying to do something productive while you do it. Like, I know, I'm going to do it while I work out. Because then I can get things done. Like, unum est necessarium? Anyone? You know? You got to find something that allows you to freewheel. Time and place, not about productivity. You know, around here, a bunch of women knit. I mean, I can kind of understand it. I didn't quite understand it at the beginning, but they knit. They knit stuff. I don't know what they're knitting. It just seems like always they're knitting. But it's something simple and repetitive and rhythmic, and that's what it is. Not much to it. But they say good things come out of it. I can't tell you how many men around here talk about the unum est necessarium that goes on when they stand out there behind a mower cutting the grass. You think about that next time you're out there cutting the grass as opposed to shoveling snow. And you're out there and your mind is freewheeling and you're fighting with enemies and making great speeches to people and winning. A few years ago, I decided that the word hurry is a word of murder. You ever have to fill these cards out, you know, for baby showers? You know, and first off, men get invited to baby showers. Like, I get it. I mean, it's a nice thing to do. But I never know what to do them, Adam. Like, oh, that's pretty. And, you know, little baby clothes and stuff, that's cool. But then they make you fill out these cards that say, good advice for new parents. And I'm like, I don't know. And then it hit me one time. I thought, don't tell your kid hurry, ever. Now, this is definitely one of these, you know, do as I say, not as I do. But it hits me now, at least every time I think to my kid, hurry. Jumping out of the minivan, hurry. I think, why am I telling him hurry? Six-year-olds don't hurry. Hurry's not in their world. I mean, you know, unless it's that trip to the restroom, but hurry's not in their world. Eugene Peterson put it this way. He said, hurry is a form of violence practiced on time. Hurry is a form of violence practice on time. It's a murderous word. Time is sacred. And I see my selfishness ooze each and every time I say hurry to my kids. Hurry. We're not going anywhere, but hurry. My son is more free than I am. My six-year-old's more free than I am. You know, hurry is what the taskmaster yells as they crack the whip over the indentured servant. But, unum est necessarium. Hurry is a violence done on time. You see, everyone, our goal, spiritually speaking, isn't really just to sit at Jesus' feet all day long. I know that sounds anathema to what we're talking about. Our goal is not to sit at Jesus' feet all day long. No. Our spiritual goal is to sit at Jesus' feet long enough so that when we go back out and live our normal life, we live as though we're sitting at Jesus' feet all day long. You see? The idea is that we would flip over our entire life to become a person who moves and breathes in our normal everyday life as though we're sitting at Jesus' feet. Because spirituality was never supposed to be weird or exotic or bizarre or artificial or contrived. No, the grace of God is only present. The grace of God is only present in our lives when we live it out in our normal everyday life. That's the only place the grace of God shows up, is when we're living our normal life. Because when you're being perfect, you don't need any grace. It's only when you're out there in the struggle, getting ready to tell your kid, hurry, that you need grace. That's the goal. It isn't to stop living and get spiritual, but to keep on living and be Jesus. But I'm convinced that we are so distracted by productivity these days. We want a faith that we can control. We want a God that we can manipulate and do our bidding to fit our values and our taste and our lifestyle and everything about us. We want a God to come and fit into us. Why? Because we can control that God. That's the God we can manage. That God will serve us. That God will be our God instead of us being gods. But God is the wildest being ever. He is not tame. He is not a vending machine. He is not a pet. He's not going to say, come here. You know, he's not going to do that when we call him. Matter of fact, even just because you unum est necessarium and pick out the time doesn't mean God's supposed to show up. Maybe nothing happens. Just you sitting in the car in the park. Feeling weird. Productivity may be suburbia's drug of choice, but perfection is nothing but pure demon. Productivity may be suburbia's drug of choice, but perfection is a pure demon. Busy suburbanites distract from their deep feelings of aloneness and anxiety and pointlessness in life by staying busy. Busy is our drug of choice. When we're busy, we don't have to think about aloneness. We don't have to think about anything because we're busy. And as I said it many, many times, you're going to walk out of here and stand out there in the lobby and sit around and drink coffee, and you're going to say, "So what's been going on?" You say, "Oh, man, I'm busy. I'm real busy." "Oh, yeah? I'm busier than you." And everybody kind of gets into a "I'm busier than you" thing as a way of saying, like, "I got a life. I'm important. I'm supposed to be here on this planet. I was born for a reason because I'm busy." Busy's good. Busy means I am somebody. I have a dream, and it's to be busy. Really. Unum est necessarium. Busy suburbanites distract. Do you know what? Moral perfection is a huge myth. No. It's beyond myth. It's tyranny. Those who believe there should be no sin are the worst tyrants in the world. Adolf Hitler believed there should be no sin. There shouldn't even be a bad race out there. So he began to just murder millions and millions of people who he thought were inferior, because the master race, according to Darwinian evolution, is going to rule the world. Fred Phelps, yeah, over in Topeka, is convinced America should be perfect. There shouldn't be any sinners in this country. So he is forced to blame homosexuals in an attempt to drive the sinners out of this country, because he thinks we ought to be perfect. The Taliban beats and kills people because they believe in social perfection too, and they make up Sharia law and make people subscribe to it. And if you don't like it, you get beaten, if not burned. And we Christians, we beat and drive ourselves with a big stick of religious guilt because we don't pray like a monk, and we don't serve like Mother Teresa, and we don't know our Bible like some scholar, and we don't give away money like Bill and Melinda Gates, and we don't do this and we don't do that, and then we walk around just so guilty because we can't do unum est necessarium. Productivity is a drug, but perfection is a demon, and you will be possessed if you chase it. Who wants to be with you more than anybody else in the world? Who loves you more than you love yourself? Who listens to you perfectly? Who has your best interest? Who will keep on loving you even when you fail, and you will fail, with adultery or divorce or lying or stealing or cheating or telling your kids hurry? Who's going to keep on loving you no matter what you do? It's always Jesus. It's always Jesus. Picking people up out of the dust. Bringing down the people who think they're morally perfect, saying, "You're not all that. You're not all that. Sit at my feet." All right, here's the big experiment I'd like to propose. These are the tricks. This is the application part. Silence. That's not a command at this moment. That's actually the application. Silence. That would be the prescription. If I'm the holy man, I'm your witch doctor up here, then this is the prescription, folks. Silence. Take on silence. This is your big RX. Find some way to become silent, everyone. You're in the season between now, 40 days in the wilderness, imitating Jesus' 40 days of fasting in the desert, connecting with God, wrestling with his demons, Satan tempting him. That's what we're trying to imitate in the church calendar right here. Heading towards Holy Week. Easter's on April 12th. All this time trying to purge ourselves of our sin. And one way you can do it with a spiritual discipline is through silence. Turn off the television. If it's not your show that you want to watch, then don't leave it on just for background noise, because it's too creepy without some noise going on. I got an old clock from my grandfather that I never knew. It's a wind-up clock. It's I think it's expensive or something, but and it tick-tocks, you know what I mean? In a very somber sort of Vincent Price sort of way, it tick-tocks. And there's nothing like being in the house when there's nothing going on and listening to that clock slowly tick off the seconds. It's creepy. You know what's good about being creepy? It's the one moment, the two perfect conditions when you feel helpless and out of control, those two perfect conditions of helplessness and out of controlness when God can speak to you. Silence is when God says, now, now that you've unplugged, maybe I could talk to you. After you're through wrestling with God, telling him all your stuff, silence comes in, and then you begin to hear the voice of God. So either turn off the radio in the car, or turn off the television, turn off something. Go for a walk. Do anything to become silent and begin to notice God around you. Silence. Because our words are meant to control our world. That's what our words do. They are our weapons. They are our enchantments. They are our magic spells. And we use words to control relationships. And when you go out to coffee with somebody and you can feel you're sitting there, you know, I do this all the time, and the other person's talking and you can't wait till they're done so you can actually interrupt them and go ahead and say something, especially after you've had about four cups of coffee. You know what I mean? You're so good, Kenny. But you know how that goes? Here's a discipline. Try this experiment, and this will be a while. I'll talk about creepy. Try to go out with somebody, you know, lunch, breakfast, somebody. Just go work. It doesn't have to be anybody special, something like that, you know? And just try not to talk. Just let them talk themselves into a corner. Don't say anything. Now, there's an interesting thing, you know, because we all know bread, words are also the bread of friendship, but also words are our ability to control somebody else. But better yet, when we begin to listen to other people and grow silent, it is an act of love and compassion. It's valuing them because they talk. They talk. And somebody actually doesn't talk back. It's so hard for me. So hard. I'm checking around here at Lakeland to see if we can do a whole day of solitude. Actually, of silence. And it'd be that Saturday before Easter, the day right before Easter. You know that day? That day? Good Friday, Jesus is crucified. Yeah, I mean, track along, you know. Good Friday, Jesus is crucified, around noon. They put him in the tomb. And all during that Jewish Sabbath rest, the body of Jesus is in the cool, dark tomb. Sabbath. God is resting from his labors. A day of silence. What's the church do on that day? What's the church do on that day? Absolutely nothing. Wouldn't it be something if around here we didn't have anything planned in the whole building? Just kept the lights down. There's no program. Nobody's going to sing a song. Nothing. You just come up for an hour. You come up all day long. Doesn't matter. Just come up and there's absolute silence. Everyone has a vow of silence. You can't talk to anybody. You can't chit-chat. There's no baristas. There's nothing going on. It's just you can come here and crash over in the corner over here. It doesn't matter. But it's just a silent day. A Sabbath. A day of not creating. Of doing nothing. Just as a way of sitting and listening, unum est necessarium. We'll kick it around. I'm still kind of hesitant whether or not we'll be able to pull it off because I think somebody's going to book something around here that day. You know? We'll see. We'll see. I'll let you know. Between now and Easter is a time of aggressive spiritual growth. Lent is a time to purge out our old self and take on the new self. It's a time of confession, a time to be sorrowful and contrite. It's a time where we confess our sins. I can't think of any other way than to do it with what we're about ready to pray, this psalm out of Psalm 51. Would you stand with me and I'll pray, and then we'll close off with this. Now, Father, at the risk of throwing a bunch of words at you when you have so much to say to us, at the risk of doing that, we come to you now in a moment to share our heart, to confess to you, to create in us a clean heart, that you honor someone who is contrite and comes clean. May we be those people right now. In the name of Christ.